Shaken and Disturbed, everyone. As always, I am Darren Karp, and I'm here with my husband, John Thrasher.
That's right. I am a husband to
You're
Darren.
A wife as well. You're a wife as well.
Yeah, I'm a wife. I'm mom, first and foremost. Let's not forget that.
Right. Well, that's what I really meant to say, but it's...
And this is a marriage, is what we've learned.
It's a commitment. It's a monogamous relationship. And we're both so heterosexual, you can't stand it. But you know how I often talk about Dan Savage and Savage Love Cast, which I listen to so much?
A great podcast.
So he's married to this guy. I love that podcast. And he's married to this guy, Terry. And whenever he describes Terry, he's like, my husband. And I can't say it any other way now.
Yeah, of
I
course
just can't.
Not. By the way, this is a great example of just the way podcasts impact us, you know, like as listeners and as hosts. It's like... You know, all it takes is one podcaster to say sussy, and the next thing you know,
It's everyone's being sussy around us. And it's just full of sus.
Exactly.
We're the susterhood of the traveling pants and the traveling drink today. Well, let's kind of get right into it. Although I know you have to kind of do a mea culpa.
I know.
At the start,
let me just mention.
Go ahead.
Yeah, last week we did our Patreon live stream, and we talked about that at length. And I told Krista, you know, I signed my first Funko Pop. It's a grumpy Pikachu. And I told Krista the winner I would send it last week. And then it fell. This is how sad my life is. It fell off of my desk. And it wasn't within eyesight anymore. And I completely forgot about it. So
you dropped it and then you just left it and forgot about it?
Yeah. Like it was. Well, I didn't drop. I don't remember it dropping. But essentially, yeah, I forgot about it. So I was cleaning like 2 days ago and I'm like, oh my God, like I haven't sent this out to her yet. So Krista, if you're listening, I have your Funko Pop. It's going to be in the mail soon. And by the way, any of you guys, if you're listening and want to win a Funko Pop from me or Darren or whomever in the future, you can sign up to be our Patreon member and you'll be joining our live streams where we do games and giveaways. That's my little Patreon plug.
Krista, I'm going to apologize for the assholiness of my co-host here because, Krista, you're the one that does, I think it's, I don't know if it's needlepoint. I don't know the correct terminology. I'm running out of, it's something like that. Crochet, something like that. Our awesome Shaken and Disturbed things, and you sent it to me, and then John got all butthurt, and he was like, I want one. And she was like, I have one for you. And then you don't even send her a grumpy fucking Pikachu.
I'm like,
give
what
me good that. Are you?
I know. You're absolutely right about that. I'm just very needy lately. But I'm looking forward to that because that little needlepoint thing looks so cool. We might have to post that somewhere, like on our group or something, if she's okay with
it. It's so freaking cool.
Yeah. Darren, really quick, let's get into the case in a second, but what are we drinking today? I will just mention right at the top, I'm having...
Oh my God, John, if you're having Bailey's or you're having the whiskey...
I'm not. I am again going to be playing tennis after we record today, so I didn't want to drink anything right now because I don't want to be dehydrated. So I'm just having a zero sugar A&W root beer. That's all I'm having.
Well, that is delicious. Who doesn't love a little root beer?
Yeah.
My brother was always loving root beer when we were kids. I go in waves with alcohol. I remember I talked about this a few weeks ago that I was trying to get into gin.
Yeah, that's right.
And my girlfriend drinks a lot of wine. And I drank wine in college, although it was like the shitty Franzia type yellow tail line. Mm-hmm. Just cheap wine. I'm not saying it wasn't good. I'm just saying it was cheap.
Yeah, we were college students.
We're college students, and she drinks a lot of wine, and I always think it's like sexy and nice to have like a bottle of wine at dinner, you know. And so I wanted to get back into wine. Unfortunately, it's like so fucking hot here, and it's like thunderstorming and humid. So I was like, I need a cold drink because red wine lately has just been getting me so tired, and it just doesn't make me feel good. And I actually got into Sancerre, which is a lovely French wine, white wine, that's nice and chilled. So I am having a glass of Sancerre today.
Oh, look at you. Is it good? Do you like it?
A sussy Sancerre. Yes, I do.
I do
like this Sancerre today, yes.
Good. I love that sussy is our thing. I mean, let's keep it going. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You get sus, I get sus. Let's get into this week's sussy case.
You're sussy in the morning, you're sussy in the evening, you're sussy at dinner time.
You're sussy at supper time.
Yeah, exactly.
When sussy's on the table, you can be sussy
anytime. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? We all know the last year has taken its toll on us in so many different ways. My friends and I have all used BetterHelp, and we all really, really love it. And I'm not exaggerating. We really do. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy done securely online. And there's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your therapist. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in that uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change therapists if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. So visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily. Visit betterhelp.com/shaken, that's better H-E-L-P, and join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states. So take advantage of this special offer for Shaken and Disturbed listeners. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/shaken.
George Sauder was born Giorgio Sodu in Italy in 1895, and in 1908, George emigrated to the United States and initially found work building railroads in Pennsylvania. I think that's around the time my family emigrated to the United States from Lithuania and Russia. So
oh, wow.
Maybe they knew each other. But after living in the States for a few years, George changed jobs, becoming a driver in West Virginia, and eventually started his own trucking company where he transported dirt and coal. Now, while in West Virginia, George met a fellow Italian immigrant, Jenny Cipriani. It could be Cipriani, right?
It's probably yeah,
Cipriani,
it could be,
it's
but
Italian.
Yeah, whatever. So it's about the same. Just, yeah.
Well, he met fellow Italian immigrant Jenny Cipriani. The two married, settled down in Fayetteville, West Virginia, a town with a large immigrant, a town with a large Italian immigrant population. Did you notice that in school at all in West Virginia? There's a lot of...
Oh, yes.
There's pockets of people, you know, Flushing has a really high population mm-hmm. of like a lot of Asian immigrants and stuff like that. Certainly pockets of Greenpoint has Polish immigrants. My family, the Jewish people, were very much so in Brooklyn. I didn't know this about Italians in West Virginia,
yeah.
but you found that. Yeah,
ahead. When I was, for those who don't know, I went to WVU, and I'm not exactly sure where Fayetteville is compared to Morgantown, West Virginia, where I went to school, but... lots of friends that I made at WVU came from, you know, the southern parts or central parts of West Virginia, and a lot of them were Italian. And in fact, one of my friends is so Italian that she is part of the there's like this big Italian festival that happens in her town, and she kind of like runs it. So yeah, not only is there like an Italian, you know, pocket of people that still live there to this day, but they take it pretty seriously. They've got festivals. They take their heritage very seriously there. Yeah.
I mean, I think we all should. And I love Italian heritage. So that's interesting. I just, mm-hmm. I always wonder how people and why people move to where they move.
I know,
me especially
too.
That early on when you're sort of kind of coming into this, could have been family, friends, but it's just interesting. Now, the couple moved into a two-story home with a timber frame just outside of town. George's trucking business was very successful, and he and his wife were able to start their very large family. Jenny gave birth to the first of their 10 children.
Oh my God.
I mean, that's a crime in and of itself. I mean, like, I can't. First of their 10 children in 1923 when the youngest was born 20 years later in 1943.
Oh,
so this is very, she's a baby machine for like,
I mean,
yeah, now 20 years of her life. This is crazy.
10 kids between 20 years, you're pregnant every other year then, right? I mean, that's kind of what I'm guessing.
Pretty much. Yeah. And, you know, outside of having to breastfeed, you're probably constantly just, ugh, you know, in the pregnancy cycle, if you will.
Women are amazing. Now, I will say this. My best friend.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You speak for all women. So that's,
yes,
that makes
I do.
Sense. My best friends who are a married couple, they just had their first kid. And just seeing what she's gone through. I mean, obviously, I know other people who have had kids, but just being her best friend through all of this, I've really come to learn what women go through when it comes to not just the pregnancy, but of course what happens after the pregnancy, specifically postpartum, that affects so many women. It's just, it's incredible. So good job, women.
Yeah, my best friend, you know, my goddaughter, Mesa, you know, so my best friend, I asked him, like, what's the biggest change, you know, outside of being a parent, like with Sharon, Sharon's his wife, and he was just like, I am so in awe of what women can do, specifically Sharon, and it's just like, it's just a great thing. Yeah, but yeah, women are obviously superior, but anyway.
That's, I mean, listen, I agree. I'm not even exaggerating, yeah.
And the Sodders became one of the most well-respected middle-class families in their rural area, and George held strong opinions on everything, especially politics and current events.
Okay.
I can kind of relate to this.
Yeah, that's fair.
Strong opinions on things. Now, although he'd been in the States for almost 40 years, George stayed very looped into the Italian political climate and was extremely and openly opposed to the fascist dictator Mussolini, as am I. Now, some members of the large Italian community in Fayetteville didn't care for George's views. And in October of 1945, a life insurance salesman visited the Sodder home and threatened George for his political opinions, warning that his house, quote, would go up in smoke and your children are going to be destroyed, quote, if he continued to speak negatively about Mussolini. Unfortunately, I mean, this happens very much so in other countries. A lot of times you don't have the freedom to speak out in the government. Thank God in this country we're able to speak out publicly and with freedom of speech. But I will say that among communities, I mean, especially this last year that we all had, what did we say over the holidays? Like, don't bring up politics, don't bring up religion, because people are so heated about these issues.
Well, and also, I mean, remember, like you just said, it's October 1945, the very tail end of World War II. And, you know, politics were at the forefront of everyone's minds. And, you know, it's just, like you said, Darren, you put it so eloquently, like, thank God we have the option to speak about whomever we want, whenever we want, about this stuff.
Yeah, I always say that no matter what, like, the fact that we get to debate this publicly, I think just goes to show how far we've come, especially compared to a lot of other countries.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think that's really important to kind of, I think United States is exceptional in that way.
Listen to you, Miss America over here.
Well, yes, I am Miss United States. She's beauty and she's grace. She's Miss United States. But I digress. Yeah. Well, another community member visited the Sodder house to look for work and warned George that his fuse box would cause a fire someday. Mm. And the specificity of the comment surprised George, as he had recently rewired his home with an electric stove, and the electric company that he'd worked with had certified his home as safe. So that's pretty interesting. It's also, you know, fuse boxes, and I don't know what they were like in 1945, but I'm not sure I would just know what your fuse box is like in your house. I mean, for ours, you'd have to come onto our property and, like, search it in order to know that the fuse box would be kind of, you know, cause an accident later on.
Listen,
no?
The amount of guys that show up to my house and say, hey, I'd like to see your fuse box, you know, listen.
Yeah, I mean, you love a fuse box, John.
I love a fuse box. No, but that's a good point. I mean, I kind of took this information like, hey, you better shut up about Mussolini or your fuse box is going to start catching fire, wink wink. You know, I don't know if that's what it is exactly, but given all of the other kind of threats and circumstances around his political views, like, I just assumed it was something threatening, but maybe I'm wrong.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I do think they're kind of related, just considering he just got his home rewired.
Right.
And in the weeks leading up to Christmas of 1945, George's sons had noticed a car parked outside near the main highway through town. And they had never seen the car before and found its presence a little bit strange, as though the occupants were watching the children as they returned home from school.
I don't like that. By the way, whenever you imagine what the car is, you know, like, don't think of it as, like, you know, a Tesla or something. We're talking 1945. Cars weren't even, like, very, very popular at that point. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of had to be pretty rich to have
them. They certainly had fewer types and fewer kinds of them. And I imagine you kind of knew, you know, who had the car. I mean, there were people who had cars, but it was like people who had cars in the neighborhood, what kind, you know, because back then, especially in suburbia in 1945, I imagine that, like, if you got a new car, whole block knew about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So something to keep in mind as we kind of move forward with this.
Well, on Christmas Eve 1945, George and Jenny hung out in their home with their children, John, 23, Mary, and 17, George Jr., 16, Maurice, 14, Martha, 12, Louise, 9, Jenny, 8, and Sylvia, 2. Oh my goodness, what a breath. That's so many people, so many kids. By the way,
I mean, and I think 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We only mentioned 8.
Yeah, that's right. There's not even the whole 10 of them. What's going on here? Well, actually, there were some people that were missing, including their eldest Joe, who had left home to serve in World War II, which I had just mentioned. So they've got one kid, Joe, that's serving in World War II, and they have a 2-year-old. That's insane to me.
I can't.
You know, that's a lot. I wonder what that must be like. Like, imagine that household with that many kids in it, like, screaming at the top of their lungs. Uh-uh.
I mean, I when my friends complain about one kid, I'm like, imagine being a single mom with 3 kids, dude.
My mom was that. I know exactly what that lifestyle was.
And they don't have the snood to, like, rock your baby to sleep here. Listen, I mean, this is just incredible. It's incredible.
And, you know, not to go into this again, but it's like seeing, you know, I have a different respect for my mom as I get older, looking back at her being a single mom, because, you know, as you learn, as you see your friends have kids and build families, you relate to it in a different way. And I look back at my mom, I'm like, how the hell did you do that? You're a superwoman. I'm so impressed by her. Well, anyway, around 10 p.m. Christmas Eve, Jenny told her kids that they could stay up a little bit longer, as long as everyone finished their chores before going to bed. Very typical, standard, middle class type of American lifestyle, I would say.
Oh my God, I remember begging my mom to stay up so I could watch Dawson's Creek when I was a kid.
Oh my
Begging her. And of course she let me, because how could she deny me Joey Potter?
You know, right, yeah, exactly. What network was Dawson's Creek on? I don't think I had ever seen a single episode of it. Do you remember?
I want to say it's like CW oh my God, it's going to be so bad, but I want to say it was that.
That
like,
makes sense.
Don't at me, anyone. I'm not Googling this.
No, that just makes sense, because I don't remember having that channel or something, and like I feel like I missed out on a lot of cultural touchstones in pop culture.
Well, you were certainly missing my cultural touchstone, realizing I was gay when I was like, oh my God, Joey Potter.
Yeah, well, fair enough. Yeah. We all have our own journeys, you know.
We do.
Well, at this point, Jenny took 2-year-old Sylvia and went to sleep. George and the 2 eldest sons, John and George Jr., were already in bed. Around 12:30 a.m. on December 25th, it's now Christmas morning technically, Jenny awoke to a ringing phone and got up out of bed to answer it. The call was from a woman whose voice Jenny didn't recognize. In the background of the call, she heard voices, laughter, and clinking glasses. The caller asked to speak with someone Jenny didn't know. Jenny told the woman she had the wrong number. The caller laughed and hung up. Jenny recalled thinking the woman had a weird laugh.
12:30 a.m., you get a call from someone you don't know. Yeah. Especially, like, you know, nowadays, I mean, hell, I get 400 spam calls a fucking day.
Me too.
But 12:30 a.m. in the mid to late 40s, where you have all your kids, woman you don't recognize, and then has a weird laugh, I'm shook.
I'm very disturbed, and that's very sus, let's be honest.
It's very sus.
Well, investigators were able to track down the caller later and confirm that the call was a misdial. After hanging up, After hanging up, Jenny noticed that the downstairs lights were still on and the curtains were still open. She thought this was odd, as the kids were usually good about closing up when they stayed up later than their parents to watch Dawson's Creek. No, that wasn't around
of
at
course.
The time, but yeah.
It should have been. It wasn't.
Jenny went down to find Marion asleep on the couch, so she assumed her other children had gone up to their attic bedroom to go to sleep. Wait a minute. 10 kids and they're in an attic bedroom? This is too much?
It's a lot for me. How do you keep track of all these kids?
How do you keep track? Well, around 1 a.m., Jenny was awoken again by the sound of something hitting the roof with a bang, followed by a rolling noise.
I'm out.
You're out.
I'm giving up on this.
This
episode
is giving me alien abduction vibes, if I'm being completely honest. Well, she didn't hear anything else and assumed it was a bird like hitting the roof or something, so she went back to sleep. At 1:30, Jenny was awoken a third time, you know, every 30 minutes, by the smell of smoke this time. She went to investigate and found her husband's office on fire. around the fuse box and the telephone line, she immediately went to wake up her husband. George then woke up his older sons, presumably so they could help get the younger kids out. Remember, the kids are in the attic, like worst possible place to be in the event of a fire. George and Jenny escaped the fire with four of their children, Sylvia, the toddler who had slept with Jenny and George, 23-year-old John, 17-year-old Marianne, who had been asleep downstairs on the sofa, and 16-year-old George Jr. But the younger children who slept in the attic, Maurice, Martha, 14 and 12, Luis, 9, and Jenny, 8, had been trapped upstairs, unable to escape their bedroom as the stairs were on fire. And the passage up or down was basically completely impossible to escape from.
This isn't very hard to get through. I know. This is just terrible. I mean, anytime it's with children, but just like being trapped inside someplace and having claustrophobia. And I think that's also why I'm so anti-death penalty, is like I couldn't think of something more claustrophobic.
I know.
Then, like, I don't know. It just feels so restrictive. Yeah. And it's just horrible. But their eldest brother, John, stated in his first interview with investigators that he'd gone up to the attic to wake his siblings. However, he later changed his story, saying he'd only been able to call up to them and hadn't ever actually seen them. This seems like a little bit of a discrepancy here. Now, because if he went up to go see them, why didn't he come down with them?
That's what I'm
wondering. How did they get trapped? So the house's telephone had stopped working. So Marianne went to a neighbor's house and attempted to call the fire department. But in the meantime, George desperately tried to rescue his children by climbing a wall of the house and smashing open the attic window, slicing open his arm in the process.
By the way, I would do the same thing. You know, if I'm a dad.
Anybody. Yeah. I mean, my God, of course, for your children, absolutely. And he and his two sons thought that they could use a ladder to get in to save the kids, but it was gone from its usual spot, resting by the side of the house. So the ladder was actually later found at the bottom of an embankment, roughly 75 feet away.
Okay, I don't like that.
I don't like it. It also seems to be like this was definitely strategic in trapping these kids up there in some sort of way. Why would a ladder be 75 feet away in an embankment? Like, who would leave that?
No.
And a barrel full of water that might have been used to try and extinguish the fire was frozen solid in the December cold. George had two work trucks at his home and tried to pull them up to the side of the house and use them to climb into the attic window. However, neither truck would start, even though they worked properly the day before.
I mean,
for two trucks not to start, two?
I mean, what is this, Final Destination? I mean, how many things can go wrong?
Have you ever seen The Strangers?
The Strangers. Is it a horror movie?
Yeah, the one with Tyler. Yeah, no, yeah. The one that came out when we were in like college, maybe like 2006.
Maybe.
And they wear masks.
Yeah.
And they just kind of like, and she like, you know, they're home. They're like trying to have this like romantic weekend in the cabin, you know? And, you know, they're in the middle of the woods and it's night out and they're trying to like enjoy themselves after, I guess, like a failed engagement, whatever. And this woman just knocks on the door. She's like, "Is Tamara home?" And I'm like, I'm done. I'm never opening the door fucking again. Like, I'm out. I'm out. So I'm tapping out of this.
You know what, Darren, really quickly, while we're talking about this case, I am going to find that clip.
Oh my God. I think it's Tamara. It might be. I think it's like Tamara.
Whatever
is
it is. Yeah. I'm going to try to find it. I'm going to insert it right here.
Okay, great.
And I hope everyone likes that little extra spice of today's episode. Keep going, Darren.
It's definitely a little spice. Mm-hmm. Not fishmonger spice, which I saw someone post on our Facebook.
Right? We're not even going down that road.
We'll get there. Yeah. We'll get there in our NMR. Okay. But anyway, completely out of options, the remaining family members had no choice but to wait outside their home for the fire department.
Yeah.
And as the family was, and I can't imagine what these children, like, were they screaming? Like, the whole thing is just nightmare.
I don't want to interrupt again, but I want to, because I can relate to this. When I was in, I want to say 6th or 7th grade, one of my best friends lived down the street from me, and their house caught fire. And I knew it caught fire. It was like the middle of the night. I saw the fire department and everything. And I will never forget. I walked down to their house in the middle of the night. I was only like, what? How old are you? Like 10, 12, 13, somewhere in there. And I walked down to their house and I was just sitting at the curb of the house, like down, you know, the curb down the block. And no one knew where they were. No one knew, or no one was telling me. I think people knew, but no one was telling me. I was just a kid from the neighborhood. There was obviously an emergency happening. And I will never forget this image. And I look at the exact curb every time I drive by it now, even at my age. And I just sat there and stared at this house on fire. The bedroom where I'd spent most of my time like hanging out and with my friends was completely engulfed in flames. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, like, are they in there? And I was just bawling my eyes out, not to be a huge downer, but thank God everyone escaped from that house and no one was...
Yeah, that must have been so traumatic for
it
you.
Was.
I mean, traumatic for the family. I'm just saying for you, that must have been very traumatic.
It was. It was beyond traumatic because I had never experienced something like that. And like not knowing if you're staring at a burning room that has your friend in it. I mean, it's the worst possible scenario. And luckily, like hours later, they must have gone somewhere, I'm sure, to the hospital or something. And my friend that survived it comes running down the street at me, and it was like this like montage from like a movie, and we like ran into each other's arms. And then I'll never forget, we sat outside my house because she stayed the night at my house that night, and we ate Go-Gurts, and that was that moment. The moment that happened. Yeah.
And I just want to say we're not sponsored by Go-Gurt.
We should be after that heartwarming, touching story. By the way, everyone survived and everything's great, so don't worry.
Well, that's amazing to hear. Yeah. Wow, what a traumatic experience.
It was,
Back to this traumatic experience, as the family was trying desperately to rescue the children, another neighbor saw the fire and made a call to the fire department from a nearby tavern. However, no operator responded.
What is going on here?
Odd, because isn't that the point of
fire
and police departments? But the neighbor then drove to town, found the fire chief, F.J. Morris, to alert him to the fire. And by the way, this must go to show, like, how small the damn town is if you know you can find the fire chief.
By the way,
cell phones back then.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought about it like that. But I looked it up briefly while you were talking, and it is a very small town near Beckley, West Virginia, which is a popular city in West Virginia, for anybody who's listening and curious.
Well, Chief Morris initiated the Fayetteville Fire Phone Tree, a system where one firefighter called another, who called another, until they'd accumulated enough of a crew to take out the fire. Obviously, there's no, like, group call with FaceTime here, you know?
Yeah.
You need the phone tree. My parents kind of had that when I was a kid growing up. You know, one parent calls the next parent.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But the fire department was understaffed due to World War II and relied almost entirely on a volunteer staff. Chief Morris also stated that the delay was partially due to the fact that he was unable to drive the fire truck and had to wait for someone who could drive it to be available. Okay, wait.
What?
How are you going to be a fire chief and not know how to drive
the
fire truck?
Right. I mean, what are you going to be a pilot but not know how to fly the plane? Come on now.
I assume every fireman can drive the fire truck. Maybe that's a stupid assumption on my part. If there's anyone out there who knows firefighters or has been through maybe the chef training course, but this seems weird to me. Now, although the fire, but again, it is maybe a volunteer. I don't know.
Yeah.
Now, although the fire department was only 2.5 miles away, the firefighting crew didn't arrive at the Sodder home until almost 8 a.m., which by the time that happened, you know, the house was just completely destroyed. Remember, they had a timber, like, A-frame house.
Right.
And once on scene, there wasn't anything for the fire crew to do besides dampen down the heat of the smoldering rubble and sift through the ashes.
Mm.
And by 10 a.m., Chief Morris told George and Jenny that the crew hadn't found any bones or remains, as would be expected if their children had burned to death in the fire. However, Chief Morris told the Sodders that he believed the children had died in the fire and suggested that perhaps the blaze had been hot enough to burn their bodies completely.
Jeez.
I'm so sorry.
I know.
Many trigger warnings out there, but a state police investigator later inspected the remains of the home and cited the cause of the fire as faulty wiring. Now, the local coroner also conducted an inquest, which concluded faulty wiring as the cause of the fire. One of the jury members was the man who had visited the Sodder home, threatening George with the idea that his home would be burned down and his children killed if he kept speaking negatively about Mussolini.
Oh, what a perfect timing. What a perfect scenario for one of the jury members to be that guy.
Seems very prescient that he would know.
Yeah.
That.
Well, the Sodders never rebuilt their home. Instead, they covered the site with 5 feet of dirt and preserved the area as a memorial to their lost children, which has to be heartbreaking. Yeah. Death certificates for all 5 children were issued on December 30th, 1945, just a few days after this went down, and a funeral was held on January 2nd, 1946. George and Jenny were too bereft to attend the funeral. However, all of their surviving children were able to attend. I find that a little bit interesting. You know, like, these are your kids. Come on now.
Right, but I could also understand, like, you know, they say, and we're not parents, but they say the hardest thing to go through is watching your kid die. They say that's literally, like, it's unbelievable pain. And I imagine that, I know you have 10, but I imagine if you're losing but let alone half your brood in this fire, God. And I wonder if George, to some extent, maybe felt like it was his fault, just because of all, like, I'm sure there was so much tremendous guilt. I don't know. I kind of understand just something being too hard to deal with.
Yeah, for sure. After everything had settled, the remaining family members began to suspect that the children might still be alive. Wait a minute. Okay, because then you're thinking, well, the ladder wasn't there, but was it removed before? Like, why was it removed? Did somebody climb up it before? Now I'm interested. Now this is getting crazy. Yeah. Well, George,
and remember, the brother changed his story, so maybe there's something more here that we don't know.
Well, George disputed the fire department's assertion that the fire's cause was faulty wiring. He had recently had his home rewired and inspected, and all was found to be in perfect working order. If the fire was really due to an electrical defect, why had the Christmas lights stayed lit throughout the early part of the fire when the power should have gone out? That's a good point.
Wow.
By the way.
Great point. Take a drink, George.
Take five. Why hadn't the home phones worked? Well, a telephone repairman investigated and found that the line hadn't been burned in the fire, but cut by someone who had climbed up the 14-foot pole.
And I wonder if they climbed up a 14-foot pole with a ladder.
With a ladder that was found in an embankment. Well, neighbors identified a man who had been seen stealing a block and tackle from the Sodders' property just before the fire. That man was arrested. The man admitted to the theft of the block and tackle, which I don't even know what that is, by the way. It was just part of our research, but we should probably figure that out. Do that and we'll come back to you. And to cutting the phone line, so although he stated he had believed it was a power line when he cut it, okay, so let me get this straight. You're climbing up a thing to cut a power line?
Wait, you're still cutting a fucking line. What are you doing?
Like, so your intention was to cut the power line? Wouldn't you get electrocuted? Do you have an update?
Also, a block and tackle is a mechanism consisting of ropes and one or more pulley blocks used for lifting or pulling heavy objects. Mm. And remember the wife at least heard something on the roof that she thought was a big kind of thud. So just keeping things in mind.
That's right. I forgot about that. Well, the man denied having anything to do with the fire. We don't have any identifying records of this man in our research, his arrest, or why he would have wanted to cut the power line to the Sodders' home. So again, as Darren just mentioned, what hit that roof at 1 a.m. on Christmas morning? A bus driver passing through town.
Was it Santa?
Because
it's been Santa?
Could it have been Rudolph and the eight reindeer? I don't know. Late on Christmas Eve, A bus driver passing through town late on Christmas Eve stated he'd seen some people throwing, quote, balls of fire at the Sodder home. Is this the Wicked Witch of the West now? You know, is it?
What is a ball of fire? Is this Quidditch? What are we doing?
What is this? There's a lot of like fantasy going on here. It's crazy.
Yes.
Well, a few months after the fire, Sylvia found a small object nearby. George described it as looking like a pineapple bomb hand grenade. The family believed, in spite of the fire chief's findings, that the blaze had started on the roof of the home, although there was no way to prove that. Why wouldn't the two work trucks start, though they had worked well the day before? Like, this is a lot of...
Right. There's a lot of questions here.
The family believed someone had tampered with them, although there was speculation that they could have accidentally flooded the engines while trying to start them in a hurry.
But both of them? Like, that just seems crazy.
Yeah, the odds of that happening are very small. And, you know, like we said, why had the ladder moved and who had moved it to the embankment? And, of course, the main question here is, like, where were the children's bodies? Because even in a fire...
Like, not a bone was found?
So we got some interesting info here that was straight from Megan, our amazing researcher, who will be on a show in a future episode. But we wanted to share some information about this type of stuff because it's very interesting. So according to firefighterinsider.com, which is a cool website I might visit after this, a standard house fire can reach temperatures of up to 1500 degrees Fahrenheit. It will always be hottest at the ceiling. You know, heat rises.
Like in the attic.
Exactly. However, it can still easily be a few hundred degrees or more at floor level. Now, according to funeralwise.com, complete cremation of a body takes roughly 2 hours at temperatures ranging from 1400 to 2000 degrees Fahrenheit.
So, okay, so to be fair, yeah. Considering the fact that the fire department didn't come until 8 a.m. and that's the fire, true. In theory, was started in the 1:30-ish a.m. range or so, they could have been cremated.
Yeah, absolutely. And okay. According to Meg, who watched a bunch of cremation videos, by the way, while researching this case, which of course Megan would do.
Megan doesn't regularly, not just for this case.
Like, I watch Marvel fan theory videos, Megan watches cremation right. videos, yeah. But correct. Even in modern day cremation, human bones need a lot of help to go from being skeleton shaped to basically being dust. I mean, think about what is right. what a bone is. I mean, it's not going to be easy to just, you know, vanish into thin air, literally. So crematory exactly. workers have to manually break apart the cremated bones with tools that look like gardening hose. It takes force and a lot of smashing, not to be too crude here, but to make, you know, a skull not look like a skull anymore, or your bone, you know, your femur to not look like a femur anymore, and really turn it into what we know is the end product.
Into dust.
Yeah, into an right. end product of a cremation. After the process is complete, a crematory worker goes in and picks out any remaining metals, so jewelry, dental fillings, medical implants, etc. It seems very unlikely that not a single remain would have been found of the five bodies that were in the attic, even in a really hot fire that burned for hours. The odds of finding nothing just seemed astronomical. So,
well, and let me just say, yeah. like, when you were talking about kind of, you know, what like the cremators kind of do, the crematory workers kind of yeah. do, when they have to smash the bones, that's under like optimal
cremation
conditions.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about like in an oven being incinerated at a constant even temperature, 100% around. A fire isn't right. going to do that, you know.
Totally.
Windows could have been open. There obviously were things in the house. So
well,
it does seem very unlikely that nothing would have been found.
And also, you know, we were talking about the attic. It's like, you know, let's be real here. If a house is on fire, the first thing that usually goes, right, is like the ceilings and the floors. They kind of like all implode on top of each other as they lose their weight. My assumption would be if you're in the attic or anything is in the attic, it's probably dropping down floors. So it's not even at probably the hottest part of the house, so to speak.
Right.
So there's that to consider as well. So there's lots of different things about arson and fires to consider here. But at the end of the day, even in 1945, there were no bodies recovered. Well, right. the Sodders right. strongly suspected arson. Again, remember the threats that we talked about at the top of the show, which led them to believe that their children may have been abducted by the Sicilian mafia in retaliation wow. against George's loud bad-mouthing of Mussolini and the fascist Italian government. Jenny became obsessed with experimenting with fire and its effect on remains. She conducted experiments on different sorts of animal bones, like beef, chicken, pork chops. She'd light them on fire and try to reduce them to unrecognizable cinders. And I mean, I just think about, like, being a family member and trying to find, if anything, justice, but especially, like, if they're still alive, you know, like, yeah. I would be doing the same thing. I mean, look at, you know, what are your resources in 1945? You got to do stuff like this.
Exactly.
A crematorium employee spoke with her, informing her that bones remain after bodies are incinerated for 2 hours at 2,000 degrees, and noted that their house was only ablaze for 45 minutes. I mean, that's true. Like, the fire department doesn't even get there till 8 a.m., but this house burned down pretty quickly.
Rubble.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And I imagine, you know, 1945, you know, it's not a mansion here. I mean, maybe, but it's a tinder kind of frame here. So right. It's not hard for that to kind of go up in flames. And the Sodders erected a billboard near their destroyed home with photos of their five lost children, offering a $5,000 reward for any information leading to them to being found. John, can you convert 1945 $5,000 into today's?
Yeah, keep going. I'll do that. I'll do that in the back. Yeah.
Okay, well, the billboard remained up until Jenny's death in 1989. There were witnesses who claimed to have seen the children after the start of the fire. One neighbor who would watch the blaze from across the road claimed to have seen them inside a passing car as the fire was still burning. A woman at a rest stop between Fayetteville and Charleston, West Virginia, said she'd served them breakfast the morning after the fire and had noticed a car with Florida plates at the rest stop parking lot around the same time. Now, remember, there was that sussy car that was outside of the house kind of monitoring, or what they thought was monitoring, the children.
Yeah.
Now, another woman at a hotel in Charleston, West Virginia, claimed to have seen four children who looked like the ones pictured in the paper a week after the fire.
Wow.
Her statement reads, quote, "The children were accompanied by two women and a man, all of Italian extraction. I do not remember the exact date. However, the entire party did register at the hotel and stayed in a large room with several beds. They registered around midnight. I tried to talk to the children in a friendly manner, but the men appeared hostile and refused to allow me to talk to these children. One of the men looked at me in a hostile manner. He turned around and began talking rapidly in Italian. Immediately, the whole party stopped talking to me. I sensed I was being frozen out, and so I said nothing more. They left early the next morning."
Ooh.
Now, the Sodders hired C.C. Tinsley, a private investigator, to look into this odd case and see if he could help locate the missing children. Tinsley uncovered some rumors around the town that despite his claim that there were no remains at the scene of the fire, Chief Morris had found a human heart at the site, which he packed into a box and buried in secret. A human heart? No bones, but a human heart?
And the fact that he packed it into a box and then buried it, I mean... Aside from that,
I didn't tell anyone.
Yeah, and aside from that being, like, disturbing, what is the motive behind that? You know what I mean?
Well, Chief Morris had confessed this discovery to a minister. The minister later confirmed this rumor with George. And George and Tinsley confronted Chief Morris with the allegation. Morris was confused by this and agreed to show the men where the heart was buried. Now, the three dug up the metal box and brought the heart to a local funeral director to ascertain exactly what it was. And the funeral director examined the contents of the box and concluded that the heart was, in fact, a fresh beef liver that had never been exposed to a fire.
Oh, my God. That's...
You know, so if you've ever had liver, I could see why someone would think that.
Sure.
But it seems a little weird that they would find fresh beef liver when an entire house is incinerated.
Yeah, right. That's very... It kind of gives me like a witch vibe for some reason. Like
exactly.
Witchcraft.
It's sussy.
It's sussy,
okay.
Guys. Everything about this. By the way, I looked it up. $5,000 in 1945 is worth... What do you think, Darren? Let's do a Price is Right.
In today's dollars, that's worth... I'm going to be so off by this. $98,000.
Not too far off. You're over, though, so you wouldn't be able to come up on stage. It was...
$72,000?
A little bit better. $75,471.11, according to
our
website.
That's, you know, I mean, listen, especially back
then.
That's
a lot, yeah.
That's a lot of money. Yeah.
Well, later, more rumors ran through town that Morris admitted to intentionally spreading the initial heart rumor in hopes that George would uncover it and be satisfied at finding some remains of his missing children and finally presume them dead. So there we go. We have a little bit of a motive.
Okay,
there.
Well, Chief Morris is sussy and he's in on this shit.
Yeah, no, for sure. Then, in August of 1949, so a few years later, George was able to persuade authorities to undertake a new search of the site of the fire. The new search was extremely thorough and uncovered a number of items that were missed in the first search, including a dictionary that belonged to the children and some coins. I mean, there's something so innocent about a dictionary. It like kind of tells me that like they're learning words, they're learning how to speak, they're so young, they're innocent. I don't know, maybe that's just me.
No, I mean, it's really sad. I mean,
yeah.
I had a dictionary growing up, and now I have my iPhone.
And now I have my Amazon Echo, where I literally ask it to define things all day long for me sometimes.
Exactly.
Well, either way, there were also several small fragments of bone that were uncovered, which were sent to a specialist at the Smithsonian Institute for inspection. The specialist's findings were very strange. He confirmed that fragments were human lumbar vertebrae, all from the same person. Now, this guy also said that, quote, since the transverse recesses are fused, the age of this individual at death should have been 16 or 17 years. The top limit of age should be about 22, since the centra, which normally fuse at 23, are still unfused, end quote. Now, that's a lot of, a lot of science talk, but the idea here is that these bones don't seem to really line up with the people who were supposed to be in the attic that day.
Given
the age range, it was determined unlikely that any of the bones were from the missing children, as the oldest was only 14 at the time, although it's possible his bones were matured enough to appear on the low end of that range. That's certainly a possibility, you know, only 2 years out from that suspected range.
Sure.
Well,
sure.
The specialist also noted that the bones showed no signs of being exposed to fire and commented that it was indeed very odd that those bones were the only ones uncovered at the site, as a wood fire of such a short burn time should have left full skeletons of all the children behind. Again, it was only 45 minutes. Yeah.
Right.
And by the way, like, you know, even for the time frame, like, given all the circumstances about, you know, where, frankly, American society was, you know, we hear about this all the time. People die in fires, sadly, as sad as it is, but usually remains are found. And, you know, so this isn't really lining up with even modern day stuff here. Well, the report concluded that in all likelihood, the bones found had come from the dirt that had been bulldozed over the site to create the memorial plot. That's exactly what I thought.
Interesting. Right.
So now these were basically bones that were being displaced from the dirt that was covered.
Something else.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, in 1950, West Virginia held two hearings about the case, after which Governor Pattinson and Police Superintendent Burchett informed the Sodders that the case would be closed at a state level. The FBI ruled that it had jurisdiction, as the case was a possible interstate kidnapping. However, they dropped the case 2 years later. After the disappearance was officially dropped, the family printed flyers with pictures of the children offering $5,000, then $10,000 rewards for information leading to the discovery of their whereabouts or anything that would have led to actual closure of this case. Now, assuming that $5,000 is worth $72,000, you know, in modern day
times.
We
almost got $150,000, you know, prize here. In which case, my guess, I would have been asked up to come to prices, right?
That's
it's
true.
It's just that I guessed the wrong conversion.
That's true. Before. You're right.
So I'm gonna rework it. Exactly.
There you go. Got to work on that one. You know, but also here's something else to think about. I mean, that's a lot of money. This family was clearly, you know, had money. I think probably people in the town were probably aware of that. And you have to wonder if that plays a part.
Yeah, remember, his business was doing well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, his business was doing well. So maybe it was a little bit like, you're going to make fun of the ancestry with Mussolini and you're going to be rich. Like, fuck you a little bit, you know?
Yeah, totally. Well, these publications offering reward money, of course, drew in all sorts of tips from around the country, which George single-handedly followed, traveling around speaking to potential witnesses and people who claimed to have leads. Nothing ever came of these tips. And you have to think, you know, like, this is, again, 1950s, barely, you know, telephones are around, and that's pretty much it. It's not like you can jump on the internet and do a full investigation here. So it takes a lot more time back then than it does now to follow these tips.
In 1968, Jenny went to check the mail and found an envelope addressed to her. It bore no return address, but was postmarked in Kentucky. Now, inside was a photo of a man in his 20s. On the back was a handwritten note that read, Louis Sodder, I love brother Frankie, ill ill boys, A90, 132, or 35. Now, the man in the photo the man in the photo did resemble their son, Louis, who was 9 at the time of the fire, would have been in his early 30s in 1968.
Ugh, so weird.
George and Jenny hired another private investigator to go to Kentucky and try to track down any leads regarding to the photo and cryptic message. The PI never reported back to the family, and they were unable to locate him again. That's interesting.
Wow.
Now, George continued to appeal to the media, giving interviews about his search until the end of his life. And in 1969, George spoke with the Charleston Gazette Mail, vowing to continue his search, stating, quote, "We only want to know. If they did die in the fire, yeah. We want to be convinced. Otherwise, we want to know what happened
to them." Of course.
Of course. And I think that's how we feel. George passed away, unfortunately, in 1969. After his death, Jenny stayed in their home and dressed in mourning black for the rest of her life until her passing in 1989. After her death, her children finally took down the billboard, offering a reward for information leading to the location of her missing children. The remaining Sodder children continue to speak publicly about their siblings' disappearance, their number one theory being that the Sicilian mafia was trying to strong-arm George into giving them money or into silence about Mussolini, which, again, if he was a prominent guy... Mm-hmm. You know, when he had money. Now, the siblings believe that the children may have been taken from the house by someone who knew about the plan to set fire to the home, telling the kids they would be safe if they came with them and left the house. These were young kids, so of course they're going to kind of believe this. And the siblings believed it's possible that their brothers and sisters may have survived and been aware of their family having survived the fire too, but intentionally avoided contact in order to protect them from the mafia. And on April 21st, 2021, the last Sodder child, Sylvia, who had only been 2 at the time of the fire, passed away at the age of 79. According to her obituary, Sylvia was unsurpassed as a wife and a mother. She filled her children's lives with scotch tape and construction paper, warm cookies, books, and unbounded love.
And what a like interesting perspective on the obituary itself, you know, like warm cookies, books. It's such a sign of the times when it comes to that type of stuff.
What a horrible story.
I know. It's really tough.
Absolutely tragic. And it just goes to show like how important it is. It just really emphasizes what we started at this case kind of talking about, is that like we're very lucky to have freedom of speech. And obviously someone can threaten you no matter what for the speech that you say, but this is just horrible. What a horrible story.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, like, will there ever be true justice about what happened? Or, you know, will the bodies, the remains ever be found? I mean, that's a sad reality about this case in particular, because it happened so long ago. And as you mentioned, Sylvia, the last remaining member of the family, is now dead, so...
Right, or at least the last known remaining member. I mean, it's possible that the other ones are still alive.
Well, that's true,
you know, obviously
yeah.
much older, you know, probably in their, 90s now?
Somewhere
maybe,
in there, yeah.
Maybe even in the 100s. But, you know, the likelihood is obviously if you haven't heard from them, it's not going to happen.
Right.
Because if the kids were trying to protect the family, once the parents went away, you know, why wouldn't they kind of... It's just... Horrible. All around horrible.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, even being from this general region of the country, having gone to West Virginia University, I had never heard about this case, so...
Me neither.
It's very interesting. I might have to take a trip down to Fayetteville and see what I can discover, Darren.
You might have
with some of my college friends. Well, guys, let us know what you thought about this week's episode. You can hit us up at JThrasher Carpe Darren. You can find us everywhere, our Facebook group. You can hit us up on Patreon. Speaking of Patreon, Darren, one of our first shout outs today is from our good friend, our new Patreon supporter, Mesa.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us all the amazing things that Mesa said?
In fact, Mesa, I just wrote you this morning. So great name, by the way. Well, she says, first off, I love you both so much. I can't count how many times you've made me laugh, cry, or just drop my jaw in the middle of my workday. Thank goodness for masks, or I'd look like a crazy person, LOL. I know you usually say that you guys don't understand how someone could listen to your voices so much, but I honestly find them soothing, and hearing them brings me so much comfort. And honestly, she went up to tell us so much more, including some kind words about grandfathers. You know, both of ours sort of passed away. I just want to thank Mesa personally for being a loyal and supportive patron.
Yeah.
We love you, and a great fucking name, because my goddaughter's name is Mesa.
That's right.
Spelled slightly differently. Her name is spelled M-E-I-S-A, but love the name, and I think it's very pretty.
That's very cool, Mesa. Thank you for your message. It was very heartwarming. Darren, not so heartwarming for me. My shout-out goes to David Archuleta, who you may know as my future husband, but he doesn't know it yet. His new single, Movin', is out now. He is also out. So please buy or stream this song so that he and I can send our children to college. You know, every stream counts, every cent counts towards, our future family. So I just wanted to give him a little plug here at the end of the show. So,
Well, speaking of plugs, and I don't know how much more you want to listen to David Archuleta talk, but right now, get 15% off our Patreon if you subscribe annually. This means no monthly building. You just subscribe for a year upfront, and you get everything from the past, the present, and the future. If you already signed up for Patreon, thank you times literally a billion gajillion. We appreciate that you support the show and keep it going every single week. We love you guys. Go to patreon.com/shakenanddisturbed. And we have a new, we have a new NMR, not murder related, episode up now. Yeah. You're going to hear a lot of updates, including what I scarfed down my throat before discussing this solder murder. Yeah. And if that's not sexual enough for you, just subscribe annually and get 50% off our Patreon so you can get these NMR episodes.
Oh my God. Now, I'm sure everyone, what you're hearing right now, Darren, is everyone rushing to Patreon to see what you scarf down.
Getting their credit cards out. That's right. Everyone wants to know what's Darren scarfing. I hear it. Well, thank you all so much for this week and for listening. And we will hear you, listen to you, see you. Neither of those things. You're going to hear us and listen to us in a week from now.
Bye.
Love you, Johnny Boy.
Love you too. Bye.
Bye.